almost 40 years of running the pet food company C&D, C&D Foods, founded by his father. Philip Reynolds is leaving the business, as I say, founded by the former Taoiseach. His time at the company's helm has seen him ride the peaks and troughs of business at a turbulent time, from recession to Brexit to personal tragedy. And now he has decided the time is right to step down now. Philip Reynolds, you're very welcome indeed.
Good morning, Marion.
To studio, you're leaving. I just want to take a sup of my tea. You're leaving the business, and it is because Brexit, and I'm very interested in your views on Brexit. But does this mean that you finally achieve your other goal, which is horses?
I wondered, was that the reason for getting me really in here, Marion? I am looking forward to a bit more time for horses, all right, but horses are definitely not the reason, the reason for the sale.
Right, but you've high hopes in Cheltenham.
Yeah, we do.
Well, you're not running...
No,
weekend.
We're not running today. Yeah. We're not running today.
Your horse is busy with
Marion Finucane, so I...
Your horse, as I heard, been mentioned last night, but Ruby Walsh is in with a shout.
Yeah, he's been touching favourite for the last 12 months, so we're 3 weeks. It'll be all over this day, 3 weeks. So, yeah, we were expecting maybe to get a run into him today, but we've avoided the temptation and we've tried to stay patient, and people might be upset with we didn't show up today, but as an owner and punter myself, I'm confident enough that we can wait the 3 weeks and hopefully...
Because he hasn't, with presenting Percy as the horse.
That's right.
Yeah, he hasn't jumped in public since last
year.
Well,
he has. He hasn't jumped a fence in public, that's correct. Yeah,
yeah.
He won the Galmoy in Goran Park a little over 3 weeks ago. So, yeah, he would be the first horse, I think, in history that will ever go to Cheltenham. And if he was fortunate enough to win a Gold Cup, that never jumped a fence in the year running up to the Gold Cup. So, yeah, it's not ideal, but as I said many times in racing circles, the idea was not to go with one run. We sent the horse back earlier this year than we did in previous years in the hope that he would have had at least a run or two over fences. But the first three quarters of the season has been like... summer weather, so, and summer ground.
Ground aid, right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So too risky to take a chance with them. So we sat and waited and been patient, and we're going to have to sit now another 3 weeks.
And what will you do if the ground is wrong?
Oh, no, I think he's arguably a better horse on good ground. So I wouldn't be concerned about the ground in Cheltenham for him, but to start him off on that sort of ground in Ireland, you'd always be concerned you might get jarred or something might happen. And we're waiting for and hoping for a bit of softer ground.
Right.
So we did get that in Gorn, to be fair to the guys down there. We got that 3 weeks ago and happy with what we saw. He won his race well there. And Pat Kelly, the trainer, has him in terrific shape and terrific form. Spoke to him at length on Wednesday evening before we made the decision not to run this weekend. And the plan is there, and it's a good plan for the next 3 weeks. So happy to sit it out and see and take our chances.
Yeah.
We'll know they say 3 weeks whether that was right or wrong. But
yeah, I know for people involved in the industry that winning in Cheltenham seems to be like beyond imagination. Like the rest of us are observers at it, but you had a winner before and you say it was just unreal.
Yeah, I've been very, very fortunate, Marion. You're talking about me being 40 years in C&D. Makes me sound very old, but I'm the best part of 40 years going to Cheltenham. And, you know, spent many, many, many years looking in over the rail into the parade ring. Dead envious of all of those that were inside, and even more so when I'd see somebody leading in a winner. And, I wondered whether I'd ever have a horse that would be good enough to travel to Cheltenham, let alone to win in Cheltenham. So, yeah, we've actually been extremely fortunate. We've had a winner in Cheltenham every year for the last 3 years. So this would be year four, and it may be a bridge too far, but we're going to try. We're
could get boring, I suppose.
never. No, not after 40 years trying to get there. That'll never get boring. No, a winner in Cheltenham is. It's the Olympics of the racing sport, as you know. And everybody would love to have a runner in Cheltenham. And there are only 26 or 27 winners in Cheltenham. So to be one of those for the last 3 years is incredible. That's not something you'll ever get bored of.
Right. You've been involved with horses all your life.
I ride horses myself. I've hunted with the Longford Hunt, and I've show jump and cross country. So keep a lot of horses around home as well. So yeah, horses, Phillips. The name Philip is actually means love of horses. So Mum and Dad must have known something about what I was going to end up doing when they christened me. But and then of course Dad was
well,
a huge...
Well, sure, he was a mad.
Mad is right, Martin. Yeah. Yes, in lots of senses of the word. But it was certainly about horses as well. But yes, yeah, absolutely. All the family holidayed in Galway every year during the festival. My poor Mum landed with 7 kids in Newcastle where we rented a house. And as we became of age, Dad would bring us maybe for a day racing in Galway. And that's where the love of the game came for the family. Right. And we all have it. We all have it to a greater or lesser extent. You know, my brother Abby is equally as mad as Dad was, and certainly equally as mad where racing is concerned.
Right, okay. Your poor mother, she didn't have much choice, did she?
No, but then she was a quiet woman. She was quiet, well, maybe taken too much for granted in that respect.
Okay, now listen, come back to C&D. You took over as CEO at just 26. Was very young. And was a surprise to you in one way?
Oh, it was a huge surprise, Marion, yeah. Because I got married in 1990 at the age of 26. And Anne and I were away on our honeymoon when our CEO at the time resigned his position. I was on my way back and I had my year planned out. And first year of marriage, I thought I ought to start the way my dad started, and that was that I had intended to go to every race meeting up and down the country for the first 12 months and put down my marker with Anne in our newlywed that this was the way life was going to be. I arrived back to Dublin Airport, or we arrived back to Dublin Airport the end of March 1990. I was met by a great old friend of mine and colleague who worked with us for many, many years, Liam Feely from Churchtown. And Liam was there at the airport, which I wasn't expecting. He shouldn't have been there. And I queried as to why he was. And he said he was here to give Anne and I a lift back into town. We were living in Dublin at the time. And on the way in, he told me that our CEO had resigned and that Dad was in the process of seeking a successor, and that he had put my name forward and had appealed to Dad not to make any appointment until I got back. So I didn't thank Liam there and then for that. As I said, my year was mapped out. But over the coming weeks, I spoke with Dad and a number of guys that were advising him. And for whatever reason, he decided he was going to...
Because you were his son.
Well, that's right. And that's not a good enough reason. And I have my own son now. And, you know, I do kind of feel in the circumstances, and we'll probably come on to talk about why I'm leaving and so forth, I do kind of feel that I'm not in a position to do for my son what my father did for me. But you're absolutely right. I got the position because I was his son. And that wasn't a good enough reason. There was... two senior managers in the business at the time, and one of them, Terry Carr, had expressed, he was our CFO, he had expressed an interest in the position. Terry was and is 10, 15, maybe heading for 20 years older than I is. And my big fear was that, for a start, I was too young. I was a kid messing in an adult's world. And the business at that size was about 15 million euros of turnover, or pounds as it was then. And for me, the question was I going to be able to keep the key members of management around me? And I sat down and I spoke particularly with Terry. And I owe an awful lot to Terry and to Adrian Glover, who was our production director at the time, because the two of them committed to me and committed to Dad that they would essentially mind me and teach me and stay with me and support me. And they did all of the above. and both of them retired from C&D after 25 or 30 years service. So whatever happened on that day, it worked.
Yeah. Now, I won't start with the fire, but the you're pretty unequivocal about what a disaster you think Brexit could have been for you from the day of the vote.
Yeah, and I still am. I don't know how long we have, Marion, but I have very, very strong feelings on it. I mean, not from my own personal point of view. I mean, from the point of view of selling the business. Yeah, the business was always going to be sold. You know, we had a disastrous fire, as you mentioned, in 2006.
How much did that arrest matters?
I mean, look, sure, it was a total disaster. I mean, we had 90% of our production facilities were destroyed in that fire, and we were essentially out of business. We had thankfully bought a small dry pet food business in North Yorkshire in 2004, but for that and how quickly we were able to restore some production in Edgerstown in the aftermath of the fire. We wouldn't have continued in business. So it was a huge crossroads in C&D's life and clearly in my life as well. So, and I had fairly grandiose ambitions before the fire as to what we could do as a business.
Like?
Well, we were a business that was founded to export. I mean, Dad founded the business in 1969. It was given some support, state support, on the basis that it would only export and not try and sell its products on its domestic market, because there was a small pet food producing company already in operation in Ireland. So it was a business that always exported, and it did, and it exported to the UK. And over its time in business had built a very good reputation and a very good business in the UK.
Right.
So our business is private label pet food. So we make for under the labels of all of the supermarket groups.
Sainsbury's and so
That's
on.
That's it.
And so
Tesco's,
forth, yeah.
Dunn's, Stores,
yeah.
Super Value now, all of the Tesco's and so forth. Yes. Yeah, so that was our business. And as I said, our territory was really the UK market. And in the end, we actually owned that space in the UK. And I had watched the business, as you said, for a long time. And I had seen opportunities for starting to develop, not just in the UK, but outside of the UK and across Europe, and an opportunity to consolidate the space we were trading in and to grow essentially the C&D footprint. And they were the ideas I had leading up to 2006. And then bang, January of 2006, with a fire, everything was laid into ruin.
Right.
And with it, I thought, were my plans as well.
Yeah, but not so.
No, again, I have to thank a lot of people, and particular the people of Edgerstown for helping me during that period.
Right.
A senior management team that I couldn't and wouldn't be here if it weren't for them.
Okay. And also a person that has been linked in a way with your father through all sorts of things. You eventually went, or you went, or your chair went, or mm-hmm. whoever went, to Larry Goodman's company.
Again, you know, so many things in life are circumstantial, and this just happened. I was very fortunate that I had, when I had all these grandiose ideas, I approached Ron Bulger, who was a managing partner of KPMG, who had served on many, many boards, including the board of Aircom and so forth. And I approached him to see whether he would be interested in taking on the chair of C&D Foods. And the reason I did that was because I knew we were going to be in the rounds of fundraising, and I wanted to bring an external, third-party, independent view to the board. And I managed somehow to convince Ron that to come on board. Post the fire, Ron approached me because, coincidentally, he happened to be also the chairman of Irish Food Processors, which is now the ABP Food Group.
Which is Larry Goodman's.
Which is Larry Goodman's own company, yes. And Ron approached me. He knew I was talking to lots of other people about post the fire, what we could do to get back on our feet and see if there was a way of not just getting back on our feet. Because at that stage, I was 20 years in the business, and having built it from 15 million to 100 million, I just didn't have the heart or the stomach to sort of believe it was going to take me another 20 years to get back to where we were in 2006. So I was looking not just to see whether we could rebuild and get back up and running, but whether I could find a way to support the plans that we had leading to 2006. And Ron asked me, would I meet with Larry Goodman? And I did. And I met with them at 5 o'clock one Friday evening.
They were old friends because they had been at family weddings.
Yes, oh yes, Dad and Larry had been old friends, yes. And yes, Larry had attended, not my wedding, but yes, he had attended some of my sister's weddings subsequently. So yes, they knew each other very well. As businesses, we never traded together. You know, even though Larry's business is very close to what we do, we would use the offal and raw materials from his business to produce wet pet food. But
well, just to go back,
yeah,
your father got the idea when he was working in a bacon factory.
Well, he owned a bacon factory in Francis Street here in Dublin. Yes, and he followed the trail one day to figure out where was his raw material that his offals, his waste essentially, where it was going. And he was paying at that stage to have it removed. So he followed the trail, and the trail led to it being frozen in Ringsend in Dublin and ending up in the UK, going into pet food manufacturing for Pedigree and Nestle.
Right.
And that's where he got the idea. He figured rather than having to pay to have it removed, if it was a raw material that he had for free, surely he could make some value from it. And
now,
that's where the idea came.
Way back then, had he talked to Larry Goodman about that?
No. They were two totally separate businesses. I don't even know, did they know each other that far back, Marianne? I couldn't honestly answer that for you. But no, there was no connection to his idea of setting up a pet food business and Larry's. And as I said, the two businesses never traded together until after Larry and I did the deal in 2008.
Had he not made soundings before, no?
Yes, he had. Larry had expressed, yes, he had, not with C&D now, but in the UK he had, which again, he's the biggest beef producer in the UK. So again, a lot of what I would consider raw materials. And yes, he had expressed interest in trying to buy a pet food company in the UK, which I was aware of. So when Ron muted the idea to me, I knew it wasn't going to be something completely foreign to Larry.
So what was the sequencing in that you say that, you know, when you saw the result of the Brexit vote, your heart went into your boots. Mm-hmm. But had you already done your deal at that stage with Larry Goodman, so you kind of had a buffer?
To sell, Brian?
Yeah.
No. The deal with Larry started in 2008. I sold him 50% of the business back in 2008.
Yeah.
On the basis that the insurance proceeds from the fire, which were about 30 million euros, I agreed I would reinvest that back into Edgerstown, which I did. And then I agreed to sell 50% of the company to Larry on the basis that of the plans that I had. I sold him this idea that there was an opportunity to consolidate pet food manufacturing across Europe. And I asked him if he were interested in doing so, I would agree to sell him 50% on the basis that he provided the funding for me to follow my dream, essentially. And that as we grew, I recognised that if the business grew, Larry would like to consolidate that back into his own ABP group business. I agreed that we should do that at 50% of the business. He couldn't do that, so he needed to own a majority share in the business. And we also agreed that we would put a number of put and call options in place, which forced us to sit down every couple of years, review how the business was doing, review the relationship that existed between him and I as two of the main shareholders, and decide did we want to continue or did we want not to continue. And over the period, and as the business grew, I sold another 25% of my shares to Larry. And so it was inevitable from 2008 that at some point down the road, the business was going to transfer. And therefore, the sale of this last remaining 15% of the business, albeit that it's happening not at a time really of my choosing, it was inevitable that it was going to happen at some point.
Right.
So I've no regrets, and the relationship between Larry and I was absolutely fantastic right up to and still is today.
And tell me then, why did you find Brexit so frightening, since this is the way you were going anyway?
Well, when you say the way we were going, I mean, I'll tell you why I found it so frightening. I've had a couple of bad experiences in the 30-odd years that I've been running C&D, and this was up there for me. I mean, on the 25th of June 2016, when I heard that the English had voted to leave Europe, I thought, I couldn't get my head around it for at least 24, 48 hours. I mean, I had ran a business that up to 2007 or 8 was exporting 90% of its produce to the UK. But for the UK, I wouldn't have had a business. I wouldn't have had a career. I wouldn't have had a livelihood. We relied almost completely on the UK. Listening to the rhetoric that surrounded the whole Brexit and Leave campaign, you know, about tariffs to trade, free trade deals, almost building a Trump-like wall around the UK to keep migrants out, ignoring the fact that they owned a piece of the six counties in the north of Ireland that seemed to be lost on them. You know, that it said everything that went against free trade. And to me, the inevitability of that was that there were going to be very, very difficult times ahead for Irish companies trading in the UK.
Okay, and then with the fluctuation in currency, that was another hit.
Of course. Like, if you look at what happened, the Irish, sterling devalued by about 20% from the time of the vote until October in that year. So over 3 months, 20% currency devaluation in the UK, where, as I said, we were, even though we weren't 90% reliant in the UK because we had grown our business in mainland Europe over that period of time, we were still very, very, very dependent upon the UK. And to put it in context for you, Mary, one penny movement in currency in our business equals €1 million off the bottom line. So over that period of time, we were looking at 14p of a movement between the vote in June and early October of that year. So that's 14 million was wiped off our bottom line had the currency remained at where it was. So, right. And again, you know, looking at where the currency has been since and where it's likely to be, even in the most benign of Brexit situations, you're going to continue to see significant levels of fluctuation in currencies.
Right.
And that's something that we need to address.
Right. Did you ever think of politics?
Sure, I did many times because I was the only one of seven children that that was remained around Longford. So every time the subject came up, and even when council elections came around, sure, you know the story yourself. Sure, is there a Reynolds? Put the Reynolds on the ballot paper and we'll surely get a seat.
Yeah.
So of course, it was put to me many, many times. And maybe at another time I might have, but I remained ambitious for the business, and
right.
If I ever felt that the business couldn't grow and continue to develop, politics might have been something I would have looked at. But I was always very ambitious, and I always thought that we could grow a business very significantly, even based out of a small village like Edgerstown in County Longford.
Right. Well, funnily enough, when you say, you know, put a Reynolds up in Longford, a close friend of yours, Brian Cowan, they put a Cowan up in his constituency, and you and he are the best of mates.
We are, yeah. I consider Brian to be a very good friend of mine, yeah. Now, Brian is a bit, I hope he won't mind me saying this, but Brian has a few years on me now as well. But yes, we are good mates. And why, I mean, Brian and I coincidentally now just went to the same school in Cistercian College, Ross Gray. But Brian was in his sixth year when I came in as a first-year student into Ross Gray. So, and as you know, in boarding schools like that, 6 years don't mingle with first years. So it's not as if we...
Of no consequence.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it's not in Ross Gray the relationship grew. But, you know, I always felt with Brian, he and I sort of shared a lot, right? A lot in common because, as you've said, I took over running C&D at the age of 26. Brian went into the Dáil at the age of 25. And so, as I said earlier, I think we were two children messing in adults' worlds. And so it continued. So, I mean, a lot of the people that I became good mates with and very close to were 15, 20 years my elder. And,
right.
And as I became sort of 45, they became 65. And now that I'm 55, they're 75. And Brian's life is not that much different than that. So... Well, I had that sort of connection.
Do you think he got a fair deal from the public?
Look, I'm not. I don't have to speak on Brian's
of
behalf.
Course, yeah.
But I always felt that in another time, Brian would have shown his qualities to be an outstanding leader, because he's. We didn't get enough of Brian to know truly how good a leader he could have been.
He was like Brian, in finance for a good while.
He was, and did a very good job.
Well, hold on the bell a minute now.
Yeah.
All those once-off stamp duties going into perpetual commitment in the public service didn't do us any favours.
No, I mean, and also there was talk about the amnesties as well. You know, but different time, different place, and, you know, Dad himself, as Minister for Finance, actually ran a tax amnesty as well, you know. So, I mean, yeah, but it's all in the round, Marion. You have to look at it, and well, at least I do anyway. And, you know, when Brian was elected Taoiseach, I think he was the most popular elected Taoiseach the country ever had. And, you know, you don't go from that, from there to where Brian went to in such a short space of time from his own doing. You know, circumstances definitely prevailed against Brian. I've no doubt about that. And I think anybody reasonable person would accept that now. I just wish that we had had more time, because I think Brian was a leader of... a potential leader for the country that could have brought the country in a different direction. And what do I mean by that? I think Brian has a huge social conscience. I think if you listen, follow any of the speeches that Brian made up to, and including his farewell speech in the Dáil, all through that speech, you'll find reference to service for people and what's good and doing right by people. And
well, that's what politicians say, you know.
Well, I do.
And
I agree.
How well you do it.
I agree, Marion. Yeah. I agree. But if you know, if you look at, I know politicians say that, but I think if we look at the performance of the UK politicians, particularly in the space that we find ourselves now with Brexit, I think they have an awful lot to answer for.
They do. But, you know, I fully understand a friend letting a friend off the hook, and I fully understand world circumstances and all of that. But there had been warnings about going on with current expenditure, with once-off taxation, and the consequences for people through the collapse of the banks. And I don't envy anybody that was in the room on that night where the guy, I don't suppose anybody does. But the consequences of the actions were catastrophic for people. Lost homes, lost jobs.
They were, and they continue to be. I mean, we're not by any means out the other side of that. And I think Brian, to be fair to him, I think Brian has acknowledged that himself, and nobody sort of feels it more than Brian himself, you know. So I think there's no arguing with what you're saying. And yes, the warning signs were there. But was that in itself what brought us crashing down? I don't think it was. I think had world circumstances not changed as dramatically and as drastically and as rapidly as they did, I think we would have had time to deal with the warning signs that were there.
Right, but Northern Rock, do you remember, was a year earlier. Indeed. Anyway, that's not your responsibility and I'm not going to say it. Does he get grief from the public still?
Brian?
Yeah.
No, I think Brian seems to have made a conscious decision to stay out of the public eye for quite a while post it. And I can understand that, because he did, as I said, he understood the anger that was there. I think people are more generous to Brian now. I spent quite a bit of time with him socially. Very, very decent guy, very nice guy, very good company, and you know, people are seeking him out now, so I'm delighted for him. He's a young man still, and you know, everybody has had difficult circumstances after 2008, but equally so too has Brian. You know, so a young man to find himself essentially out of work young family.
But not out of work in the same way as others.
Well, if you're unemployed, you're unemployed, Marion, regardless of what your circumstances.
If you've got a good pension, a good Taoiseach's pension, or a good ministerial pension.
It doesn't get you out of bed in the morning, though, Marion.
Right,
so for the peace of mind.
Now, there was a lot of affection for your father when he died. Do you feel he left people with a mostly positive view of him? Because there was a huge amount of turbulence and court cases and tribunals and all of that. And then, of course, there was the peace process.
Hmm. Well, again, he's another character in Irish public life that I think you would have to sort of look at his contribution in the round as well. So, you know, for all that was going on, that was noise, as I would describe it, like you've just mentioned about tribunals and about court cases and whatever. You know, that was a part of the character that was Albert Reynolds. The other side of the other side of that same coin was the man, you know, that negotiated. The many billions of investment post the Maastricht Treaty was the same man that stood in at the Fianna Fáil Ardesh, which is coincidentally happening this weekend as well. Just a plug there, Marion. But, you know, promised everybody telephones.
I was thinking about it last night because I covered that Ardesh and I had applied for a phone that year and I was told I might get one in 3 or 4 years' time. Years' time. And I was thinking of it in the context of rolling out broadband now, where it, you know, go on and on and on and on. And he just stood up and said, I'm going to get a phone into every household. And he did.
Yes, and I say there's a generation now of people that couldn't really understand that.
It's jaw-dropping.
It is, really, you know, that we were, alive to even, to live through that. Yes, I agree with you, but that was the same man. And this, you know, so, as I said, it's in the round, and to me, has he left more positive than negative? It's not, look, that's not for me to judge, I think.
You're proud of his work in the peace process.
Of course, I'm proud of him, his work, full stop. I mean, he gave me a chance in life that, as I said, I'm not in a position to do for my own. So for everything that he has done, I'm proud of him.
And in terms of the Beef Tribunal, and of course that brings us back to Larry Goodman and all that, well, how did he cope with that in the privacy of his own life?
The way he coped with many issues of a similar sort of nature, he would himself and Mum would sit down, two of them with a cup of tea and a biscuit, and they would discuss it. And that's what he did. He never got stressed over it.
Did he not?
No, genuinely not.
And because it would appear that he did, because look at the trouble he went to suing the Times.
Yeah, yes.
And you know, appointing Harry Whelan, God bless him, I mean, that's all in the balance too, like pig-headedly.
Yeah, but that's not stress. He didn't do that out of stress. I mean, you know, the case that you referred to against the Sunday Times, for argument's sake, I mean, he didn't do that out of stress. He the paper, as you know, called him a gone bean man.
Yep.
You know, like, I think that's a slight on us all. I mean, at the end of the day, whether you like Albert Reynolds or dislike Albert Reynolds, you know, he was the leader of our country. And do we think that it's right that the leader of our country, any more than the leader of any other country, ought to be called a gone bean man? So, I mean, and the reason they called him that was they said that he lied to the Dáil. They didn't say that he misled. They said that he lied to the Dáil. So, like, it was fairly serious, not just for him. It was a fairly serious accusation that was being made about the leader of another country, that he would go in and consciously mislead and lie to his colleagues in the Dáil. So
this was, like, in connection with the Sunday Times
case that you refer to. So, I mean, he took that case because, first of all, he expected that the Sunday Times would apologise and that the case wouldn't go to court. And I think on reflection, that's what the Sunday Times ought to have done, because albeit that there was no award for damages at the end of it all, the court found that, in fact, Dad was right, that he did not lie to the Dáil or mislead the Dáil, and the Sunday Times apologised thereafter.
OK, can you just give me a chance to go back to that time? It's only a very, very small clip. I was on Liveline at the time, and the November 1996 court ruling, which didn't award damages, I spoke to his wife, your mother, Kathleen.
Kathleen, are you there?
I am, Marion.
Kathleen Reynolds, good afternoon to you.
How are you, Marion?
Well, more importantly, how are you?
I'm thrilled.
Are you?
I really am. I'm thrilled.
10 out of 11 jurors have decided that my husband is not a liar. And that means so much to me. I don't know the full story yet.
Well, the full story isn't as good as you might wish it to be. The question about whether or not Albert Reynolds lied to the Dáil and his colleagues, they said that he did not.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah, well, isn't that what he came to London for?
Well, yeah, but they didn't award him any damages.
Well, now there's, he was just on the line a few minutes ago.
Yeah?
He said this matter hasn't been cleared up at all yet.
Oh, really?
Yes, so I cannot elaborate on that. The matter hasn't been cleared up at all yet.
Right.
Yeah, so I can't say.
Did you find it all very stressful, Kathleen?
Very, yeah. It was, yes.
Can I ask you, at any stage, did you say, I wish to God we'd never gone ahead?
Well, you know, from the very beginning, I was, I kind of said to him, you know, I prefer if he didn't go ahead.
Yeah.
But then he said, all right, you know, and he expected they would give him an apology.
Yeah.
The apology wasn't forthcoming, so I didn't blame him then. I left it to himself to make up his own mind.
Right. That was what happened at that time. You cannot take away from your father, you know, how he commenced the peace process and all that. But if you take the tribunals and the court cases and losing two governments, what was it about him that got into that mess alongside his success?
As I said, I think it was... he was a businessman in politics, and whether business and politics mixes as well is a question that I suppose we could all ask, because
impatient.
He was.
But how did you take the fact that when the tribunal report came out, it sounds like comedy, except it was very serious, that one section of the government buildings was blocked off from the other part of the government while two separate sentences were joined together to describe vindication.
You seem to be a lot closer to all of this now, Marion.
Well,
than
I was doing a bit of reading. Yeah,
right. My memory is that there was a dispute as to whether the part of government buildings was blocked off or not blocked off. But I mean, it's all history now. But
it
I think,
is. But
I think what's important.
Two governments.
No, I think that's right. I think that's what
with
I was
Desi O'Malley.
No, I think that's right. I think your point is a fair one. It's not about whether government buildings were blocked off or not. But yes, there were two governments that Dad was involved in that collapsed.
Largely due to him.
Well, it takes two, Marion, as you know, and he did say that he wasn't a great fan of coalition governments, and maybe his track record proves that to be the case. So, you know, I'm not covering for him. Yes, two governments collapsed under his leadership, and that is disappointing. I there's part of me that would say, yeah, had he taken time and drawn breath, maybe, you know, those governments could have lasted. And I'm sure they could have lasted longer. Would they have achieved as much? I don't know whether they would, because, as I said, he was an impatient man. And once he made his mind up about something, and once he gave his commitment to somebody, he stood by that, and that got him into trouble ultimately. I mean, the whole Harry Whelehan affair, for example, was a result of Dad giving his word to Harry Whelehan that he would appoint him. He stuck by that, and when others left the room, he continued and appointed him. And ultimately, you can say that it was the Brendan Smith affair or whatever, but ultimately, yeah, what brought down that government was his loyalty to Harry Whelehan. As I said, but that's Dad in the round. For the same man that collapsed two governments, would somebody of a different ilk have been able to get all sides in the north and further afield to come together? He was a great man to build relationships, but it was relationships for a common purpose.
Right. And I know it was a very close relationship with John Major, because John Major has said so, and has said so on the record. During the Mahon Tribunal, it was advised that he couldn't give any more evidence because he had cognitive problems. Now, naturally, people thought this was ducking and diving. But has it transpired?
Yeah, but to be fair to those people, I suppose, Marion, you know, they didn't have the benefit of hindsight. Yes, Dad was diagnosed, as everybody knows. Dad had Alzheimer's and was in the early stages of it. At that stage, I can tell you there was nobody who was more gung-ho about wanting to go to the Mahon Tribunal than Dad. And it was the family and his medical support that convinced him that for his own sake not to go there, because he would have been sworn in under oath, and what he could and should and right. would have said, you know, he would have had to stand over. And he wasn't in a position, Marion, to be able to defend himself with the way he would had he been in the full presence of mind. And he just wasn't. And as I said, time has shown that there was good reason why he didn't show to the Mahon Tribunal.
And terribly sadly, your mother's going through it now.
And that's just when I was listening to the clip. I didn't know that clip. Rachel mentioned to me during the week that you had found that clip. I mean, it's I'd have two reactions to that. One is it's a precious piece of video because, or of tape. Because I don't think my mother ever did an interview with anybody. So for you to catch her like you did, well done to you, well done to you. But the other thing that I reflect is just to hear her voice again, because I haven't heard Mum's voice for 2 years now. So yeah, she was diagnosed sadly with early Alzheimer's as well, and on a weekend with Anne and I in Mullingar, she sadly had a stroke. And the saddest part about it is that she was in her room, and I went down the following morning to call her, and I found her on the ground and in the bathroom. And to this day, Marion, I don't know whether, because the bed was made, and that would be my mum. She would never get up out of a bed, even if she was at home or in somebody else's house, without making it and leaving everything perfect. And so the bed was. And when I went in and found her on the bathroom floor, I didn't know whether she had got up that morning and collapsed in the bathroom, or whether she had actually spent the whole night there. And I'll never know that. But to hear her voice like we just did there now, it's lovely to hear.
Right. OK, well, I actually did meet her quite a few times in the context of aftercare for cancer patients, yeah. Because she was very strong on that,
she was.
Having been through it herself. So now you are leaving, moving, turning over a page. What's next?
Well, an immediate priority is Cheltenham in 3 weeks' time, Mary.
Priorities, right, and yeah.
See whether we can bring the hopes of the Reynolds family to Presbury Park. Yeah, I'm talking. Look, I've had some very, very good people around me. I work very closely with Gerard Flood, who's the former managing partner of corporate finance and KPMG. He and I are good friends. He challenges me every step of the way, and he and I have been speaking about various things that we've talked about down through the years,
right.
And I haven't had time to do so. I'm going to have a look at doing some of that. I also am very grateful for where I am at this stage in my life. I'm still in my early 50s, so I still see life in front of me. But I also want to try and give back something as well to life. So Anne and I have some plans about what we'd like to do in that regard. So, yeah, new chapter, Marion.
OK. Well, listen, thank you very, very much for coming in to us. And good luck in the future. And certainly good luck, in, as you say, in Presbury Park. Philip Reynolds, good morning to you.
Good morning, Marion.